Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Scheckman. 54 years ago, at the height of the Cold War, John F. Kennedy addressed the nation and said the following.
Acting therefore in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere, and we hope around the world. God willing, that goal will be achieved.
It's hard to imagine that for young people growing up today who see the Middle East as the center of American military and foreign policy concerns, for over 50 years and eight presidents, Cuba had been at the center of American concerns. 90 miles off America's shores, for the entirety of the Cold War, it represented the penultimate point where Americans and Soviets were eyeball to eyeball. Today, when celebrities have been traveling to Cuba for a while, when the door is officially opening, most people wonder what all the fuss was about, especially as the current president, almost as a bookend to JFK, addressed the nation on December 14, 2014, and said the following.
In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas. Neither the American nor Cuban people are well served by a rigid policy that's rooted in events that took place before most of us were born.
In between these two speeches have been twists and turns in American policy, in U.S.-Cuba relations, and in American politics that have profoundly impacted the relationship. And now perhaps that relationship will be impacted again by the death today of Fidel Castro and the election of a new American president. Few understand all of this better than my guest, Peter Kornbluh. Peter Kornbluh directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive in Washington. He is co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. And it is my pleasure to welcome Peter Kornbluh to Radio Who, What, Why. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you on a historic, if sad, day.
As we look at the death of Castro and comments from world leaders pour in, to what extent is his death at this point going to affect policy inside Cuba, Cuba's relationship with the rest of the world, or Cuba's relationship with the U.S.?
Well, those are definitely loaded questions. Fidel Castro became an iconic figure, dominated the world stage, as you said in your introduction. Certainly, the shadow of his influence hung over the last 10 years of Cuban society's march forward under his more pragmatic and more modern forward-thinking brother, Raul. But U.S.-Cuban relations also, I think, are going to be affected by this turn of events, which comes at a very delicate moment in the history of the two countries with the advent of Donald Trump. And so the answer to your kind of three-part question there is that in Cuba, Cuba itself is going through a transition, really away from the Castros altogether, as Raul Castro himself prepares to step down from power in a couple of years. It remains to be seen if any member of his family will succeed him, or which part of the Cuban Communist Party leadership will kind of ascend in his wake. But clearly there's a debate and a struggle going on. There's factionalism in the Cuban Communist Party about how far to go with these reforms that Raul has started. And you saw that particularly in the wake of Barack Obama's visit to Cuba in March of this year, where some of the hardliners really stepped forward and said, well, this is just the Trojan horse approach, killing me softly with your song type of approach to changing our society in Cuba, and we should reject it, and tended to want to reject also the move towards privatization as well, because that frees up kind of independent sectors of the Cuban society. Fidel's kind of legacy, his principles about socialism, the purism of his approach will certainly be invoked by, I think, hardliners in Cuba that don't want to go that far forward with significant reforms and modernization that Raul has been leading. And oddly enough, in the wake of Fidel's death, Raul's own kind of credibility and reputation and his own intent to change Cuban society and create a situation for what he calls sustainable socialism will become all the more important. But certainly there'll be a struggle to invoke Fidel's name. Of course, Raul Castro is his brother, and so still for at least a couple of years commands a more significant kind of influence in that debate. On U.S.-Cuban relations, the real issue here is that Fidel's death has kind of elevated Cuba onto the agenda of American politics at a time when it would have been much preferable for Cuba to just lay low, and the whole issue of communications with the incoming Trump administration becomes a kind of quiet thing for them, everybody to settle down and see what how Trump is really going to approach this. And instead, you have Trump, you know, having taken the opportunity to say things not as hard as he could have said them, but so far, but still implicitly suggesting that he's going to be much more forceful in trying to change Cuban society and Cuban politics than Obama had been. And of course, the Cubans will get worried that the United States and the incoming Trump people will think that this is some opportunity for them to intervene one way or another in Cuban affairs, and they'll become very defensive and very negative, and the kind of rhetorical war will escalate quickly. That's my greatest concern. In terms of Cuba's relationship with other countries in the region, you know, Fidel had a very prominent legacy around the world, and he gained that legacy for himself and for Cuba by standing up for the anti-apartheid movement, supporting Nelson Mandela before anybody else did, sending troops into Angola to fight the colonial powers and the CIA, sending doctors around the world to help impoverished societies. He has a lot of respect, and Cuba has a lot of respect in the Third World, and I think that's going to show in the commemorations and tributes and the memorial service that Cuba is going to have fairly soon for Fidel. So that's what I think the situation is now.
You've written about the degree to which the efforts on the part of the U.S. and the part of the Obama administration to normalize relationships have gone so far at this point that it's going to be very difficult to put the genie back in the proverbial bottle. Talk about that.
I think President Obama deserves a lot of credit that he hasn't really gotten yet for really going the extra mile to try and support, make irreversible the kind of the normalization of relations with Cuba by opening the portals of diplomacy, even-handed diplomacy with the Cubans, something it's hard to imagine Trump emulating, by opening the floodgates of commerce, authorizing direct plane flights, for example, to Cuba, which invests all the airline companies in carrying passengers to Cuba and makes them kind of ready lobbyists to sustain the normalization process. In opening the door for literally tens of thousands of U.S. citizens to go, and even though there's still technically a travel ban, basically we can all designate ourselves as people-to-people ambassadors and go to Cuba, and many people are doing that. And all of those people are also a constituency for going forward with normal relations. So Obama has tried to build these bridges in the few weeks that he, you know, first it was a couple of years he had left after his announcement of normalizing diplomatic ties, and then after his trip to Cuba last March, which I had the great honor of going on as well. He had 7 or 8, 9 months left. Now he's really got literally 6 or 7 weeks left. And so he's pushed this forward and deserves credit. The truth of the matter is pretty much what Donald Trump says, however, which is that because the Republicans in Congress have said no to Obama at every turn, not just on Cuba policy, but on just about everything, the embargo still stands, and what Obama's accomplished has been by executive order. And Trump started going around Miami to try and get hardline Cuban-American votes by saying everything Obama has done by executive order can be rescinded and reversed by the next president, and I will reverse his executive orders unless Cuba meets our demands. And one of the lessons of the book that I did with Bill Liljegrand about the whole history of secret talks with Cuba and negotiations with Cuba is that Cuba doesn't yield to U.S. demands. That's not the way we move forward and have moved forward, and it's not the way Obama moved forward. Trump seems to feel that we can make some kind of deal here with the Cubans that gets them to change their political system and change their independence in return for lifting the embargo. And he's got to realize that, you know, 10 presidents before him made that kind of suggestion to the Cubans, and they basically said what Che Guevara said back in 1961 to the first Kennedy emissary, our system of governance is not on the negotiating table. And so we're just not going to move forward. And what I fear is that we'll move backwards, particularly if a rhetorical war breaks out between Donald Trump, who is clearly going to be using the bully pulpit of the presidency in a much more bullyish way, and the Cubans, who absolutely refuse and have refused for more than 50 years to be bullied by the United States of America.
Is there any reason to be hopeful or to think that there's anything positive in those 50 years of on and off, behind the scenes, back channel negotiations, that it set any kind of predicates that could be useful given the pressures that will be brought to bear today?
There are a whole list of lessons that presidents before Trump learned, and that if Trump was patient enough or had the attention span to learn, would greatly benefit him. Obama, to his credit, learned those lessons. One was Cubans don't yield to demands. Two was that doesn't mean they're not interested in negotiating and working with the United States and having a peaceful coexistence with the United States. Quite the contrary. Fidel Castro, you know, even with all his anti-American rhetoric and his yelling about Yankee imperialists, actually, you know, reached out to every president since Kennedy with some kind of olive branch about modus vivendi and a peaceful coexistence. So the Cubans understand that from a security point of view and just from a validation of the revolution point of view, it would be better to have normal, peaceful relations with the Colossus of the North than to be in a state of perpetual hostility. But they're ready to be in that state, and they had been in that state for over 50 years until Obama came along and finally understood that it's not that you make a deal with the Cubans. You move forward because of your own unilateral interests, the interests of the United States of America, and you say to the Cubans, we're going to move forward because it's in our interests. We think this is going to have an impact on you down the line, but we're really not demanding anything of you in return. We need Alan Gross, the prisoner, to be released, and we'd like to see other political prisoners released and human rights improved, but we're not building quid pro quos here. This is the right thing to do, and it's high time that we do it. And most importantly, treating Cuba with respect and respect for their sovereignty and respect for their independence, and adopting a tone of equals. Che Guevara, at one point back in 1961, said to a Kennedy White House official, Richard Goodwin, thank you for the Bay of Pigs. You've allowed us to consolidate the revolution and allowed us to transform ourselves from an aggrieved little country into an equal. And Cuba sees itself, even though it's much smaller, as an equal, in international stature to the United States and wants to be treated with respect. And Obama, in his tone and his approach and the secret negotiations and the public negotiations, has adopted this very magnanimous and kind of even-handed tone, which is, as I mentioned, hard to imagine after January 20th, 2017. So that's where we stand. Trump could learn from all of this if he wants to move forward, and it remains to be seen if Trump, the businessman, prevails, understands that it's good for business to maintain positive relations with Cuba, or Trump, the politician, who promised these Cuban Americans that he was going to roll back the normalization process and, you know, try and get a deal with Cuba and make Cuba meet our demands.
The fact that there are diplomatic relations at the moment, that there's been this exchange of embassies, to what extent can that be helpful?
It's very helpful, but it doesn't necessarily change things if a war of words breaks out. And you have, on the one hand, a president who's incredibly thin-skinned, and on the other hand, a country that has suffered U.S. aggression for over half a century and is very sensitive to the slightest hint of a national security threat from the United States of America. Let's not forget that the CIA tried to assassinate Fidel, you know, more than a dozen times, and that we invaded Cuba, and that we stood poised to obliterate the island during the Cuban Missile Crisis if the Soviets hadn't pulled those missiles out, and that the embargo was originally, you know, intended to squeeze Cuba economically until it imploded. Now the embargo has many holes in it because of Obama's use of his executive authority to open avenues of commerce, but for many years it didn't. So the Cubans are kind of used to aggression, and there's some people, you know, some of the older members of the Castro government even prefer that kind of place in history of standing up to the causes of the North. But it's obviously in nobody's interest, not Cubans, not U.S. interest, to escalate any tensions. But we're now at a time which is very delicate. We were at a delicate time before Fidel died, and today we're at an even more delicate time in kind of the road forward to this incredible process of normalizing relations between what Wayne Smith once called the closest of enemies.
In this process of normalization, has it had as yet any real economic impact on Cuba?
I think so. I've been to Cuba six times this year. I've gone regularly four or five times a year for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. Anybody who's traveled regularly to Cuba has seen a remarkable kind of transformation just on the street since Raul Castro took over from Fidel. And that's part of this effort to privatize at least part of the economy, open Cuba up. Cuba's recovered largely from the special period, but it's in very difficult straits now because of the political crisis in Venezuela. It's trying to get new kind of suppliers of oil. It's trying to pay its bills so they can get international credit. So Cuba's not out of the economic woods, but there's a dynamism, at least to the tourist sector, that's pretty extraordinary, and people are gravitating towards that sector. And to the degree that Raul Castro continues to allow the slow privatization of certain parts of the economy, that's the degree to which Cuba rebuilds a new kind of resource base for the future and for the social welfare services that they want to give to their people. And they really can't do it any other way, and that's why they're doing it this way. So I think a change has happened. Could that change be reversed? It's hard to know who's going to be the authority figure and who's going to carry this forward. I mean, Raul is 86 years old. His brother has died at 90. Really, we're talking, you know, substantial changes between over the next 2 to 4 years in Cuba in terms of leadership. It's truly unclear who is going to have the authority to move the country forward. And since we don't know who it is, can't really say for sure what kind of positions they're going to take.
I guess to your point before, whether Trump approaches this from a political perspective or a business perspective really does seem to be a key indicator, because clearly the business opportunities that will present itself are going to be substantial given normalization at the moment.
You know, there was this great story that came out during the campaign of Trump in the 1990s surreptitiously sending a team of businessmen to Cuba to explore the idea of opening casinos there and illegally paying them for their fees to go to Cuba and the money that they charged him, upwards of $68,000, completely circumventing and evading the embargo laws, particularly in the 1990s, which said you couldn't pay people to go to Cuba and try and do business there. And so he clearly remembers the time when he was interested in the hotel industry and the casino industry in Cuba. And, you know, he's a guy who's always had an eye out for making a buck. You know, it's clear that normalization is better for business and that Cuba is open for business than to use the embargo to kind of try and shut off Cuba again. And I think Trump, ironically, certainly understands that if you close the doors of U.S. commerce to Cuba, Cubans open it them more with the Canadians and the Spanish and the Mexicans and the Chinese, particularly the Chinese. So that's not particularly in U.S. business interests. And on the other hand, he's a guy who likes to tell other people what to do, and he likes to bully them into doing it. And that's the formula that worries me the most. There are some countries out there that will deal with him on that level. The Cubans are not one of them.
What allies are there that Cuba has at the moment that might be helpful in providing perhaps a buffer between Cuba and the U.S. through all of this?
I think that's a very good question. I think you're going to see the entirety of every major country in Latin America rally together to push Trump to sustain this policy of normalization with Cuba, because the rest of Latin America and many other countries believe that it's in their interest as well. And those same countries ganged up on Obama when he first became president 8 years ago to change the policy. And they certainly were incredibly influential in giving him a stark choice. Either the United States accepted the inclusion and return of Cuba into the inter-American system through an invitation to the Summit of the Americas, or the rest of Latin America was just going to boycott the summit and all the economic perks and deals and integration that happens at these big meetings was going to go by the wayside because of the Cuba issue. And so Obama did understand that the rest of Latin America wanted this to happen. You know, whether that kind of thing has an influence on Donald Trump or not is hard. It's hard to tell. He doesn't strike me as the person who thinks the diplomatic argument is significant. He wants to make America great again, and it seems to be defining that as pushing other countries around to make the deal that we want them to make. And as I say, the history of secret talks and negotiations with the Cubans, Fidel Castro and then Raul, shows that Cuba just isn't going to be pushed around to make a deal. They don't do the tit for tat. They don't do the reciprocity. They don't do the quid pro quos. They will respond to initiatives, but on their own kind of timetable. They certainly are interested in better relations, and I know that they hope that this normalization process goes forward.
And finally, what kind of pomp and circumstance can we expect to see as Fidel is laid to rest?
I've been trying to explore that today, it seems like there is a whole kind of set of different memorials, kind of citizens' participation. There's an event in Havana, I think the day after tomorrow. Fidel's ashes are going to be carried from Havana to the other end of the island, Santiago de Cuba, which is in a reverse of the famous revolutionary march that he made in the first week of January 1959, when Batista fled and the revolution triumphed, and he took a caravan of jeeps and drove from Santiago to Havana. And now his remains are going to go back the other way, which is kind of a poetic circle. And I know that the older Cubans will appreciate that. And then he's going to have his ashes interred on December 4th in Santiago de Cuba. And it appears that there's going to be a ceremony on December 3rd and a ceremony on December 4th. And it's just not clear to me yet if one of these is going to be a major international event with dignitaries, et cetera, or if they're all kind of on an equal footing, depending on who's where in the country, for Cubans to pay their respects to Fidel Castro, the father of the revolution.
Peter Kornbluh, I thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
You know, it's a great pleasure. I hope your listeners get something out of it and that they stay engaged in the Cuba policy debate.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shechtman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.